Welcome, everyone, to the pilot episode of the Joshua Cuzmic Experience. I am your host, Ryan Sullivan, editor-in-chief of NatsGM.com and the Baron of All Baseball Podcasts. And, of course, my tag team partner, the man who the movie Jerry Maguire was based off of, Joshua Cuzmic. Josh, how are you?
I'm good, and that movie was not based upon me. I don't work in football.
But I did want to get actually kind of start there and just what are your thoughts of Jerry Maguire as a movie and their representation of them as Jerry as an agent?
It is a fair representation of Scientology. I like the Kelly Preston scene in the beginning with Jerry. I don't know if that's realistic. I mean, but there are some vague similarities to the relationship between him and Cuba Gooding Jr. in the movie. That's somewhat realistic. That relationship, when you get that close to the player and his family, that's real, I think. And that captures a little bit of the essence of what the job is. But the day-to-day minutiae of what the job is like, managing a player, it's completely different. And, you know, it's very funny. One of my good friends always says, you remind me of Bob Sugar. And I'm like, I don't know if that's good or bad.
Because
people always say, oh, it's like Jerry Maguire. And my friend makes a point every time when someone says that. It's like, oh, you're like Bob Sugar. And I'm like, you dick. So, but no, it's that's kind of how people know what a sports agent is, and I've come to accept that. It for a while I resented it greatly, but it's okay. It's a good movie. I like the movie. It's a chick flick in disguise, just like Bull Durham. Bull Durham is a chick flick in disguise, and Jerry Maguire. It's a very good movie, but it has some scenes that are very good that are. Mimic the job. My favorite scene in that whole movie is when he's with his client in the airport, and he just is at his Jerry's at his wit's end, and looks at Rod Bidwell, and he goes, "Do you want my jacket, Rod? Because I don't need it. I'm cloaked in failure." And that was the truest line of the whole movie, because you know, as an agent, you feel like that a lot. You know, you just you're like, "God damn it!" Like you know, you just think of guys you scouted that you've missed and. You know, contracts that you could have had by guys who fired you or guys that you decided to stop working with or guys you decided not even to go up to and could have had a chance to get. I mean, I could give you hundreds of players that I just missed or you know, worse. And, you know, there's always a good success story like the Rod Tidwell. So, you know, there is a happy ending. But, you know, I do have a funny personal experience with that. I actually had a client call me one time years ago, I was 26, so what, 7 years ago, and he was at a party, and I had less boundaries back then with my clients, and we reenacted the Show Me the Money scene around midnight, one in the morning, and I had to scream into the phone that, show me the money, I love black people, you know, that whole scene, word for word, verbatim. Which is all true. I mean, those are all true things. But, you know, I have people money, and I do love black people. So now that happened. I was screaming it at 1 in the morning at my apartment. That fortunately, I was living alone at the time, so it didn't seem that weird.
Not that weird, right? Yeah.
But verbalizing it now in my 30s seems horribly weird.
Right, exactly. Particularly sober at not 1 in the morning. Yeah.
I was sober. The player... at the time, not sober, so I don't work for him anymore, sadly, but he's still playing, and good for him.
That's kind of awesome. Is there one player that you could mention that really sticks in your craw, like, darn, I should have gotten him?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I whiffed completely on J.D. Martinez. I was at every single one of his games his junior year in college, and I didn't think he was good. I whiffed on him. I was wrong. Michael Fiers was there too, and on the same team. I didn't think he was good, and I completely whiffed on both guys. And if any scouts tell you that they were in on those guys in college, they're liars. The only two people on earth that, like, those two guys out of college were Greg Brown, who is now the coach at Nova. He's the guy who drafted JD, and Bruce Seid, who passed away, the Brewers scouting director, loved Michael Fiers. And he tried to convince me to like Fiers, and I laughed at him. And then at the next winter meetings, I apologized to him because I was very, very wrong about both those players because, I mean, Fiers is a strikeout machine, and J.D. Martinez is just such a good player. And I'm telling you, I had zero interest in either guy. And there was a third player there who played in the major leagues on that team, Miles Nicholas, who I loved, and I thought he was going to be the best of the bunch, and I was wrong. And a similar thing happened years earlier at the Area Code game. There were three pitchers on this one team. Tommy Hunter, Lance Lynn, and Josh Lindblom were on the same Area Code games team. Mm-hmm. And Tommy Hunter, I didn't even look at. Lindblom was the guy I fell in love with. And Lance Lynn is a guy that I liked, but he was going to college, so I didn't really pay that much attention to him, even though his dad was very, very nice and he was a good pitcher. And again, I freaking whiffed on Lynn and Tommy Hunter.
Yeah, Lindblom went to college, right? He went to Purdue?
Yeah, but he ended up not being the pro that the other guys did. And same thing with Nicholas and Martinez and Fiers. Fiers and Martinez are big leaguers, and Nicholas is in Japan. So well, I've done that twice. Fortunately, I'm not the only one, so... I make those mistakes. I mean, it happens. It's part of scouting. For every awesome 30th round story I have where it's like, hey, that's like, we've got a 34th round, he's a big leaguer, I've got a bunch of stories where it's like, I should have signed that guy.
Well, let me give you a chance to flip the question around then. Who were you particularly right about? Who were the one that you nailed?
Oh, I mean, Bobby Casavo went in the 34th round, played in the big leagues. Taylor Green, 25th round, played in the big leagues for 2 years. Michael Brantley was a seventh rounder. Steve Clevenger was a seventh rounder. So I'd hit on later guys. I mean, I'm sure I will never ever hit better than Brantley in the seventh round. So he might be the best seventh round pick in a long time. So
maybe ever.
One. Maybe. Hopefully it plays out that way. But, I found late guys. I did a story last week. We talked about that. I've got four guys on the verge of playing in the big leagues. Brighton Trepanier went in the 41st round. Seth Lugo, who was on ESPN the other day, which blew my mind that he's finally getting attention, which is well deserved. Seth is he was a 32nd rounder from Centenary College of Louisiana.
The Gents.
Lugo's the guy that I feel like the most vindicated about because I remember watching him for the first time and I just looked at everybody else and I'm like, wow, this guy's ridiculously good, and no one cared. And I'm like, am I the only one who sees this? Like, is this a joke? And, you know, I signed him and he struggled in the Penn League, and then he got to Savannah and dominated. He went to Florida State League and led the league in strikeouts, and now he's in the Eastern League and he's dominating. He ended up on ESPN. Like, it was like so blatantly obvious to me that this guy was good, and everyone else, aside from the Mets who drafted him, obviously just kind of slept on him. And I love him. I mean, the makeup was there and the ability was there. And Lugo is one of the guys I'm more excited about than a lot of people. So that's a good one. I like that one. But I've got some painful ones that suck.
And I'm sure the painful ones stick with you more than the success stories.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You always wonder, like, oh, that guy's making $5 billion now. That's great for him. Awesome. Glad I slept on that.
Yeah. Glad I missed that check.
Yeah, that was horrible.
For those that haven't heard it, can you tell your Michael Brantley story? Because I think it's phenomenally interesting just how the process of being an agent works.
I went to Tallahassee Community College to Pittsburgh Pirates Scout Day, and I was watching Yonder Alonso play, and his father actually demanded to throw batting practice, which is not common at the pre-draft workouts. It was a bit odd, but they let him do it because he was a big-name guy. This was when he was out of high school, and he had an okay day, but I just happened to sit down behind home plate, and nice lady in her 40s was sitting next to me, and we start talking, and she says that her ex-husband, who she doesn't really talk to, played in the big leagues for about a year or two, and her son was trying to get drafted, but was most likely headed to IRSC, Indian River, State College. It's community college in St. Lucie, and they expected him to go there, but they weren't sure he was going to get drafted high enough to sign. And she said, "Do you want to meet my son?" And I said, "Sure." So after the workout was over, I walk over by the parking lot to meet her son, and it's this giant black guy, and I'm like, "But you're white. I don't understand any of this." And you know, it threw me a little bit, but then I put it together. I was like, "Oh, your dad's black. That makes sense." And that's how I met Michael Brantley.
That's unbelievable. Now, did you keep in touch with him from the time you met him, or how did that relationship go?
I was representing Darren Ford and Lorenzo Cain at the time, and I don't work for Cain anymore, regrettably. But Michael got drafted by the Brewers and ended up living with those two guys. Then I got hired.
That's amazing.
Mm. Yep. So that's how that happened.
And now he's maybe the best player in the American League.
He's pretty good. Yeah. He's pretty good. He's right up there with Mike Trout and probably kick below Miguel Cabrera, but he's pretty damn good.
So another movie that I wanted to ask you about is Moneyball. What are your thoughts on the on Moneyball?
I have this profound hatred of Moneyball. I hate it. I appreciate the gravitas of creating a new way of reinventing the wheel, but
so you're not a Jonah Hill fan.
That's not the problem. Hear he's a dick. I hear he's not the nicest guy in the world, but he's good in The Wolf of Wall Street. I like that movie, but Moneyball is something that I read the book and was disgusted by it. And the nice thing about reading it, there's two things about reading it that are just wonderful now, is the perspective you have now, just how Michael Lewis is in the draft room chastising the Royals for drafting a high school pitcher named Zach Greinke, or chastising the Brewers for taking a high school first baseman named Prince Fielder and saying what stupid picks they were. And in baseball, you can't instantly judge. I mean, you can't instantly judge any draft pick, in my opinion, but especially in baseball, you can't make that instant call that you can do maybe in football when you see Andrew Luck, when you know he's the next Peyton Manning.
Right.
But in baseball, you really have to wait years. That's why it's never been that good of a televised event, because fans aren't going to see these kids for 5 years. So reading it, you know, now, the perspective, it's hilarious to read it, because I think every single one of their draft picks, with the exception of Swisher and Bonderman, washed out. And Bonderman was the guy that they flipped out over taking because he was a high school arm, and Billy Bean went nuclear for taking him. But I got in trouble for one thing. I made a comment that I said, why not bring it up again if I got in trouble for it? But I said I don't remember there being many parades in Oakland since Moneyball came out, so that was my comment there. But my favorite part of Moneyball is when they released the book. I believe it was the year before the Marlins won the World Series in 2003. And in 2003, the Marlins won the World Series with five high school pitchers in the rotation, and I love that. And they had one college guy at the end. It was Mark Redman, because A.J. Burnett blew out his arm. But it was Brad Penny, A.J. Burnett, Josh Beckett, Carl Pavano, and Dontrell Willis. Mm-hmm. And and Moneyball had to write an addendum to try to explain how the Marlins were an anomaly, not the rule.
Just right. I mean, you got to fit your narrative in, whatever you can do.
I still like the eyeball test. I know it's not scientific. I integrate numbers into what I do when it comes to the business. But when I'm scouting and I'm at a game, it, for me, it's makeup and gut feel. I've been pretty successful with it, and you can't judge a baseball player by looking at a computer screen. You can't. It's impossible. You know, makeup and drive and ability and you know, there's some analytics that are very, very helpful, but you can get a little overboard on that. And someone made the comment to me, well, and I think it's in the movie, you know, the Red Sox took the Moneyball approach and won the World Series, and like, well, yeah, they had a $150 million payroll with their two best players were in the Mitchell report, so ta-da.
Yeah, I mean, that was a little disingenuous, to say the least. They weren't Moneyball. They were taking some of those principles with $150 million payroll.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of defeats the purpose of Moneyball. Moneyball is to get players on the cheap. They were buying most expensive players and applying those principles, you know, and multiplying it times 100. So,
well, and I love, Johnny Damon was the example of somebody you shouldn't buy, and then lo and behold, he goes to the Red Sox. But they're doing Moneyball.
Yeah, Johnny Damon, don't get him. He won't help you. And it's like, the guy's borderline Hall of Famer. Come on. So I'm not a fan of it. I can't believe that movie was made. That's absurd to me. It's bizarre that Brad Pitt played Billy Bean, because, you know, I have to work with Billy Bean, so... it's bizarre.
The movie was awful. The whole thing with the daughter was just such a crowbarred in to make it, you know, kind of a feel good movie, and it was awful. The whole
poor Philip Seymour Hoffman playing Art Howe. What the hell?
Yeah, first of all, he's a great actor playing Art Howe. What is that? But yeah, I mean, he was.
I just
love
that they needed an actor to play Art Howe.
That's another great. Why couldn't you just have a regular old Art Howe play Art Howe?
They picked an Oscar winner to play Art Howe.
Yeah.
I mean, good God Almighty, what was that? And
Jonah, I mean, Jonah Hill had to be Paul D. Podesta only because he was heavy, I guess. I mean, that was the only criteria for that role.
Jonah Hill was this combination of five different people in the book, and some of the scouts in the book, I actually know them. And Jonah Hill's character is not a real person, and stuff like that in movies pisses me off. Like, I saw Argo, and I loved Argo when I saw it, and then I read about Argo, and Ben Affleck said he took some artistic license with the movie, and the last 30 minutes of the film, which to me were the best parts of the movie, The Escape, well, those parts apparently never happened. And I get so angry when you see something that's based in reality, and then they take the artistic license and change it. I don't think you should do that with things that are factual.
Well, and on top of it, my biggest criticism of that movie is they never once mentioned that the Athletics had Hudson, Zito, Mulder, and the MVP of the league, Tejada, in that movie.
They never mentioned that, and I agree with you completely. That rotation at that time is the reason that Moneyball worked.
Right. You know, and it was kind of lucky in some ways. I mean, Hudson was, what, a fifth or sixth round pick that was more of a hitter. You know, Zito was a top pick. That was a good hit. And Mulder was a decent round. I mean, he was a northern kid, but, you know, not
exactly. Mulder was great before he got hurt.
Sure.
He was terrific.
But I just love the only time you saw Hudson in the whole movie is he's getting shelled for 14 runs.
Yeah, they gloss over their wonderful rotation that you know is supposed to be the second coming of the Braves, and there's no one right way to do something. It's got to be, if you apply it to real baseball, it's got to be a blend of everything. And by the way, I have a great idea for a side business. Did you see Trouble with the Curve?
Unfortunately, yes. Although I do like Amy
Adams. Singularly the worst baseball movie ever made. I think it surpasses John Goodman's The Babe.
Yeah, agreed.
Like awfulness of baseball. And I'm convinced that, like, I watched the credits purposefully. There was a baseball consultant on Trouble with the Curve, I want to start a baseball consulting business for movies.
Yeah, no kidding. First of all, I'll start with, no scout looks like Justin Timberlake. Can we start there?
Okay, no scout looks like Justin Timberlake. That's number one.
There's not a lot of Amy Adams running around either.
Yes, obviously no Amy Adams running around scouting either. Secondly, what team is going to allow a rookie area scout to take a guy 1-1?
Yeah. Well, and what pick played selected at 1-1 isn't scouted before 2 weeks before the draft? That's another one that I thought was great.
Or scouting by sound, that's a new one.
Well, hands have to move. You can hear the sound. Really?
And wait, hang on. There was one other part that annoyed the living hell. Oh, the peanut vendor kid. Yeah, let's have him come to a stadium workout to face our major league team and face our first-round pick, who's immediately in the major league, and have him pitch in beans and continue to strike him out, you know, with curveballs and breaking balls and, you know, 100-mile-an-hour fastballs and saying he's Steve Carlton and Sandy Koufax. And the best part, best line of the whole movie was John Goodman playing the general manager saying, this kid's going to need an agent because that would happen.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many referrals I've gotten from general managers.
Oh, I'm sure they happen all the time, every day.
They're like, this guy's worth millions. Let's get him what he's worth.
Yeah, let me hand you some money while I'm at it, too, on top of it.
We could sign him for $1,000 versus $6 million. We better give him the $6 million. People ask me, your parents. I had a parent ask me this weeks ago, you know, why do we need an agent? And I said, if teams gave players what they were actually worth, my job would cease to exist.
That's, yeah.
And I think you saw it. Houston Street just renegotiated his own deal without an agent, and good for him. I think that's awesome. I think that's ballsy as hell. But that contract seems a little bit not in line with what the market is right now.
Right, correct.
You know, I mean, at some point, yes, every player says, how much money do you really need? But my thought on that is these players have a limited window of earning power, and they should maximize that as much as they can. And there is something to be said for being happy in a hometown discount. I am for that. But man, when you see a guy like Houston Street putting up the numbers he is in the market that he's in, making now $9 million a year, and no shot on a comparable player, but a guy like Luke Gregerson signs a 3-year deal for $18 million, why does that happen?
Right. I mean, hey, David Robertson signed for $46 million in the offseason. Yeah, he's not David Robertson, yeah, exactly. But he's 80% of Robertson, probably.
I think he could have done better than 2 years, $18 million.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. So,
I wasn't involved in the negotiation. Neither was any other agent. But good for him for not having to pay an agent fee. But the way that I look at it, just use smaller numbers. If I'm helping a draft kid, and the kid gets, let's say, the first offer from the team is $40,000, and I get him I help get it negotiated to $100. The kid's paying me $5,000 to make $60. So there is an intrinsic value to having an agent.
And that actually gives me a nice segue to another topic that I wanted to talk to you about, is the draft. You're kind of famous that you've stayed out of the draft the last few years. I don't know whether you're back in this year or not, or what you're doing, but just kind of, where has the draft gone, and where is the role with, I guess it's an advisor, not technically an agent, which is kind of nonsense to begin with, but just kind of your perspective on the draft itself.
I mean, it's still broken. They're fixing it. They're working on it. I have a guy this year that I'm advising that is doing really well. I don't get to talk about him because I'm an advisor, but he's doing well, and the process with the teams hasn't changed all that much, but the mechanisms have changed. Signability is important, as always. Ability, you know, that's important too. Scouting never really changes all that much, but I think a worldwide draft would be good. I mean, the NHL has it, and I think the worldwide draft would be a good thing. And I agree with Scott Boras says, where you see a situation where a guy like Jose Abreu gets $68 million on the open market, but then Chris Bryant has to sign for $6 million. So, you know, I'm not saying everyone's a free market, but I do think everyone should be on the same playing field. You know, the loopholes are crazy. So I'd like to see a worldwide draft implemented. I think it'll happen in the next EBA. I think that's going to be brought up. I personally hope that happens. I think I say that because I don't have any hand in the Latin market, because I know a lot of agents that are in that market would probably kill me for saying that. But you know, for someone like me who doesn't have anything to do with the Latin market or in very minimal role in the draft, I don't have any qualms with a worldwide draft if done correctly, which that's always going to be the caveat.
Another thing that you said that jumped out to me was, what have you seen in terms of the difference between the new slotting rules that I guess this is the third or fourth year now, and, you know, when it was, I don't want to call it the Wild Wild West, but a few years ago prior to the, you know, tougher rules?
I've been through both. See, the thing is now the slots are set by the commissioner's office now. Before, there was always a suggestive slot system, you know, in the Wild Wild West days. These are kind of, like, it's a hard slot now. Before, I mean, we always had slot numbers, like, we always did, for as long as I've been working. It's just, you could choose to pay attention to them or not. Adrian Yetto, when I had him in 08, the slot was 180, and I got him 376. But the only way you could get that kind of money as a whole is either having a team know the price tag in advance and take him and sign him for that anyway and agree upon it, or have a really lengthy holdout, which would essentially destroy a player's first season. So with the signing deadline moved up now, the holdouts are shorter. And the kids that sign for slot tend to go a little bit higher, and that's good, I guess. But it's tough. You don't see those. I had a 30th rounder get $500,000 once, and picks like that don't exist anymore because of the budgeting. So that's been eliminated. I mean, Mark Trumbo went late one year and got $1 million, and you miss out on picks like that. So that's changed for sure. But as far as what I've seen, and I'm not, you know, the last time I dealt with the Wild West, I had a first rounder. And then the last time I dealt with the new system, I had an 11th or an 8th rounder and 11th rounder. So it wasn't the same ballpark. But from what I've seen this go round is, I mean, it's similar, but I haven't had to experience a holdout yet, so in the new system, so we'll see. But there are differences, but it's still dealing with scouts, it's still dealing with teams, it's still dealing with the family, it's still a lot of it's the same.
Another guy that I wanted to ask you about, and I don't want to say it too specifically because it's not your player, but Brady Aiken and the situation that happened in the draft last year, I wanted to get your take a little bit on why is it that, and I'll speak for the team to a certain degree, if I'm going to be investing $3, $4, $5, $6 million, I almost feel like it's my right to be able to see that man's medicals, at least on his arm. I mean, I don't need to see it, you know, on his, you know, whatever, but is this a situation that we could see change? Because I feel like this whole situation could have been done a lot better. Just kind of your thoughts on the whole situation, as much as you can talk about.
It sucks for the kid. It sucks for the team. I wasn't part of any of that, but man, it's hard to improve your draft stock on 1-1. I don't know any picks higher than that, so I don't understand the mechanisms of not signing, going 1-1, but to each their own. With that being said, the medical stuff's always tricky because of HIPAA rules and laws, and there's always that hesitation that teams would use it against you and make it public. So baseball's talking about having a combine, which I don't know how that would work for baseball, but football it makes sense. But and then to a point, the NHL has one too, and the NBA has their pre-draft camp in Chicago, but baseball doesn't really have anything like that. So I guess it's good that progressively that they're at least talking about it, and I don't know how they'd implement it, but right now the medical records are at the player's discretion, and I know of one situation where a former first round pick had a torn elbow ligament, didn't tell the team about it. Team took him in the first round. He threw a bullpen his first day in camp. He said, "Ow, my elbow hurts," and needed Tommy John surgery, and now he's one of the best prospects in all of baseball. So Tommy John isn't a death sentence, but, you know, good for the kid. He got his money, and the team has the player they wanted. So, I mean, you know, if Brady Aiken comes back and is the player he was supposed to be, the 1-1 guy, then he's worth his money. If he doesn't, then he's not. But
where do you sit in terms of the medicals? Do you think the team has some, I don't know, obligation is not the right word. Do they have a right to see them?
As of now, no. But I'm a player advocate. I mean,
right.
You know, so where I stand, I think, yeah, I mean, in a perfect world, sure, why not? But, you know, in reality, the way the system is, I'm fine with it. You know, I mean, I'm not for hiding injuries, but I mean, Brady Aiken himself didn't know he had whatever issue he had. You know, Dylan Covey a few years ago was the Brewers' first-round pick, got diagnosed with diabetes, like, mm-hmm. right before the draft, and he had no idea he had diabetes. And the Brewers lost the first-round pick, and the kid decided not to sign and got drafted way later the second time around, and I don't know. I mean, there's very few situations going back to the draft where a guy turned down first-round money and does better. I mean, yeah, there's Garrett Cole and Mark Appel, but I can tell you a lot of other ones that got drafted really high and never got drafted again or got drafted later and regretted not taking the money.
Well, God, who was the Colorado pitcher that got drafted four different times?
Matt Harrington.
Oh, that guy. He got drafted every year and never signed.
Yeah, Matt Harrington, what was he drafted, five times, turned it down?
And a couple of top, you know, first-round picks, I think one even in the top 10.
Yeah, the Rockies, he was the eighth overall pick.
Unbelievable.
And then, you know, you have another kid, this is a horror story, Jake Kiliopoulos with the, Kiliopoulos was a second-rounder of the Blue Jays, his hometown club, and he didn't sign over, I think, $50,000, and $100,000, they had a disagreement with the advisor, and he ended up going to Chipola, and didn't play and bounced around school to school, and he never got drafted. I mean, he got drafted again by the Dodgers, turned the money down again, got drafted by the Blue Jays, turned the money down again, and he never played professionally, and he ended up killing himself. But it's like, obviously he had problems before that. I knew the kid, he's a terrific kid. Yeah. And it's just sad. I wish I could instill any kind of, like, the wisdom of a 29-year-old kid into these 18-year-olds to let them know, you know, this money is not always going to, this isn't always going to be there. Just because you're worth, you know, 500 out of high school, you know, it doesn't mean in 3 years you're going to be worth $6 million. That's not how it works. There was a kid I advised out of Nova, who's no longer playing, Cody Stiles, who had a different advisor at high school. He turned down $430,000, I think, out of high school by the Yankees, and then he never got drafted again.
God, that's a house. I mean, God.
I mean, there's tons of stories. I mean, yeah. When I first started, I had a guy named Kyle Friss who went to the Royals, signed as a senior sign for $1,000. He got offered $750 out of high school. Didn't take it, got signed for $1,000.
Wow, what a shame.
It's horrible. I mean, Kyle's out of baseball and seemingly has a good life. I don't really talk to him much these days. I haven't seen him in forever, but Cody I still talk to. He's at Nova and works out and trains, and he just signed an indie ball contract and unfortunately blew out before he could even get a chance to play indie ball, but at least he got a pro contract, but that's more than a lot of guys get, and there are just so many horror stories of guys that turn the money down and you never see him again. And there was one semi-prominent one that I had written about that was a big-name prospect at the time, Devin Shepard.
Yeah, I remember that name.
He was the number one. He was the number one ranked junior college player in 2006, and I begged him to go to Chipola, but he ended up going to CCSN where Bryce Harper went, and it was a wood bat league, and just he was decimated. And ironically, hit one home run on the season. It was on the road at Chipola, and so I told you, and he ended up turning down $300,000 or $265,000 in the fifth round back in the day in 06 out of the draft at high school, and then ended up signing, I think, for $30,000 or $40,000, and then was out of baseball in 2 years.
Jeez. So I guess the last question I have for the draft kind of topic is, so how does baseball and, you know, everybody clean this situation up? Does a worldwide draft all of a sudden solve a lot of this?
Well, it's one or the other. You do a worldwide draft, you make everyone a free agent. So, I don't know.
Well, and they'll never go for that. The free agent option, they'll never do. So
they used to.
Yeah, but they, like you say, there's just no way they would allow the situation where they would be paying a 18-year-old kid $68 million.
No, I don't think they'll ever. They never would go back to that, but I think a worldwide draft would go a long way to fixing a lot of, you know, the big mistakes that teams, you know, the big investments that they make. I mean, it's, you know, they're investing all this money in Latin America and Asia, and it's nuts. I mean, the money's crazy, and look how many guys, just veterans, like veteran Asian players, came over and their game didn't translate here. And I mean, for every Hugh Darvish, I mean, who's amazing, you get Hideki Urabu.
Kaz Matsui. Yeah.
Yeah, Kaz Matsui or
the Nakajima guy that just came over for the Oakland who had to go back. I mean, yeah, it's...
Yeah, or any of the pitchers that, you know, in the 90s, like Bang Hoon Lee or any of those.
Oh, wow. But, yeah.
You know, he stopped Troy. He was a big leaguer.
And, yeah, I remember that name for sure. Yeah, Cubs prospect.
So, or what was the Dodger guy, Tin Feng Tin?
Yeah, God, and forever he was on prospect list, that guy.
Yeah, he was the first Korean player ever in a home run in the big leagues. But yeah, he didn't have the career he should have had or could have had. I mean, he's great in Korea, but he's still playing there. But yeah, I mean, the worldwide draft would go a long way for helping clubs mitigate the international money. I mean, because at least from my understanding and my perspective, the more money that goes to the major league pool, the better it is for everybody. And a worldwide draft would certainly go a long way to taking some of the resources from, you know, international free agency and such, and pulling it towards the major leagues. I mean, that's kind of the ultimate goal here. So a worldwide draft would go a long way, I think, into doing that.
And I guess I lied, because I do have one more question. What is your favorite draft story? Is it Adrian Nieto?
Yeah, it's definitely Nieto's.
I got to give you the floor. You got to tell the story then.
The Nieto one's my favorite. He held out for months. They had not signed their top 5-round pick. Aaron Crow, Ian Desmond, I don't remember who the other guys were, and Nieto was one of them. And about a week before the deadline, I get a call at 6 in the morning from Jim Bowden, on speaker, from the front office, and everyone was there. Boone, Dana Brown, everybody, the whole front office was on speaker, and he just asked me, where are we with the Nieto situation? I'd just gone over it with the area guy, and I said, look, this is what we're looking for. You know, we're looking for a certain amount of money. Here's this expectation. If we don't get it, you can just go to USF, and we'll deal with it in 3 years. And before I could finish my sentence, Jim starts screaming at me in front of the entire front office. And just at the end of his diatribe, he said, in 3 years, I guess we'll be dealing with Scott Boras instead of someone like you. And I said, that's fine, but good luck with your legal problems. And then he hung up on me.
And this is right when the Smiley Gonzalez stuff is going on, for those that aren't, you know, passionate Nationals fans. So, yeah, which actually got him fired shortly thereafter.
Yeah, so like the next day, Rizzo calls me and he's like, hey, Josh, this is Mike Rizzo. Jim doesn't want to talk to you anymore, so I've taken over negotiations. And he said, we've got double the slot, 360. Is Neo good for it? And I tried to get 400. And then finally I go, can we do 376? And he goes, how did you come up with that number? And I said, do you want the honest answer or do you want the BS answer? He goes, I like honesty. So I said, well, there was a fourth round catcher who was taken the year before who got 375. And I hate the guy's agent and I want to make him look terrible. And I'd like to get Nieto $1,000 more than this kid, even though they're comparable players. And he goes, is this for you or is this for the kid? I'm like, this is 100% for me. And he goes, fine, I'll give you the 376.
That's so great.
And I did it. I got him 376.
That's so great. Now, I guess he was a Rule 5 last year with the White Sox. Went up there.
He's in Double A now. He's working on his game and hopefully gets back up there at some point in September and hopefully next year too.
That's too funny. I miss, just as a Nats guy, I miss Nieto. I was hoping he would be a long-time Nat. He's a heck of a defensive catcher and can also hit a little bit.
I don't think the Nationals expected him to stick all year. I think they underestimated him a little bit. I'm surprised. It's the first time in a long time, and Rizzo's a very good front office executive, and I was surprised, and I don't think it was entirely on him, but I'm very surprised that you would send a kid to the Arizona Fall League and then not protect him in the Rule 5 draft. That's uncommon, so that was surprising, and it speaks to the dearth of catching. Like, Nieto is struggling right now in Double-A, and they needed to make a roster move, and they took Javi Guerra off, the 40-man, who they owe $1 million to this year before they took Nieto off. So, you know, switch hitting catcher with good defense, even though Nieto's struggling.
Yeah, I mean,
they still kept him.
Yeah, I mean, that's still a very, very good backup. You know, with and like you mentioned, I think you did anyways, he's a Cuban, so on that team with Abreu and a few other of the guys, that's really helpful as well.
Oh, yeah, and he's bilingual, and he came over when he was seven, and it was a great, it's a great story. ESPN, I think, wrote about it, how he came over, and he went to probably the greatest high school. He was on the greatest high school team I'd ever seen. The infield consisted of Nieto at catcher, Hosmer at first base, second base was Nick Castellanos, and shortstop was Evan Marrero.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, all at the same time. That was their 2, 3, 4, and 5 hitters.
Mm. And who was on the mounds? Was it Sulbaron?
Juan Carlos Sulbaron, who got $500,000 in the 30th round.
Which is another great story of how you got him a half a million bucks in the 30th round.
Yes, that was the kid who I got a $500,000 for. He's in Double A, actually, having a very good year after 7 years of toiling around. He's playing very well, and I don't represent him anymore, but awesome kid, really good kid. I love him, and he has a cool story, interesting kind of, not a throwaway story, but he opted to not be a free agent, to come to school in the States, which I will never understand that to the day I die. So he took himself out of free agency, being as how he's from Curacao, and he made himself draft eligible. And Heritage was, at the time, supposed to develop a pipeline to Curacao, and they were supposed to have a kid the following year go to Heritage. He was enrolled, but he ended up signing as a free agent instead, and he was supposed to go to Heritage to replace Evan Marrero and this guy named Jurickson Profar.
You've got to be kidding. That's amazing.
But Profar was wise enough to realize that maybe going in the draft is not the best route for me.
Yeah, that, you know, probably a good move. What did he sign for, a couple of million bucks? Yeah.
I don't think Jurgen Profar is regretting not coming to American high school.
That is amazing. But how did you get? But tell the story about Sobran. Tell the story about Sobran, because I think that's the first time I became aware of you, and I think that story is just amazing.
Went to Heritage and had a commitment to Florida, and everyone thought he was going. The dad wanted an astronomical amount of money for his kid, and he got drafted by the Reds real late, and their first offer, I think, was $125,000, and it wasn't close to what we were looking for, and as time went on, it was a real lengthy holdout. This holdout went longer than the Edo's, and he ended up signing. He pitched in the honkball tournament in the Netherlands, and he ended up, it's on YouTube, he struck out five on like three pitches, and the team got really serious after that about trying to sign him, and they offered, I think, 260, then 350, and then like the day before the deadline, they offered the $500,000 number, and we had to like get all kinds of paperwork done with the union that we agreed to terms, and not really an extension, but we needed to make sure the paperwork came in on time because it was coming in from the Netherlands, and it was very hectic and confusing. And long story short, he ended up signing, and he got $500,000 on literally deadline day. So that was good. That was a good story.
That's just crazy. I can't believe that he actually became a Dutch citizen to try to get that money. That's so great.
He was a Dutch citizen. Actually, I left part of that out. He's from Curaçao. He was a Dutch citizen, and he pitches for the Dutch national team still. And the thing I did leave out is the other part of the leverage that was increased is he had an offer to pitch in the league in the Netherlands for a certain amount of euros that was tax-free, and the Reds ended up matching the amount of money what the euros were worth, so he didn't play professionally in the Netherlands for 1 year and then become a free agent.
I love that move. I absolutely love the move. So
I don't know. I mean, it was a very, I don't know how I thought of that or how that came about, but it did and it worked and probably would never work again. But because if I had a kid from Curaçao now that was that good, he'd probably just be a free agent. But if there ever is a draft eligible kid from the Netherlands and he plays here, just get an offer from a team over in the Netherlands and leverage it against the clubs here. That's the trick.
And just call it the Josh rule. That's
it's a good rule.
Yeah.
Looks like the combine. If they get a combine, it's the Brady Aiken combine now.
That's very true, and that's got to happen. So
I think it will. I think it will. I'm going to play a minimal role in that because I don't know what my involvement in the draft is going to be. I mean, the kid I'm advising this year is a friend of a client, and I originally agreed to do it as a favor like I did the last time I was in the draft, and so far so good. So we'll see.
Good luck to that player to be named sometime
player
this summer.
Be named later.
Yeah, sometime this summer. So last name I want to ask you about is just Jeremy Jeffress. I know you represent him. You've represented him for a long time. It's a wonderful story, and I think that maybe this is a good place just to kind of let you tell his story a little bit from maybe even from your perspective.
Oh yeah, I mean I've known JJ since he was 15. I watched him in Jupiter at a Perfect Game event when he was a sophomore, and I met his dad, and I really liked him back then, and this is before he was even first round caliber kid. I just liked the arm, and I scouted him real early in my career, and stayed in touch with him, and ended up not getting hired out of the draft. They went somewhere else, but by the time he got to Pro Bowl, he was playing with Jeffress, Kane, Brantley, Ford, Taylor Green, Stephen Chapman, Brent Brewer. I had every Brewer at the time back then. I have a lot now, but I had even more then. I had like nine of their top 15 prospects back then, Alex Perriard. Literally, I might have had nine of their 10 top 10 prospects, so I would see him all the time, and we were friends, and he knew me from back then, and then finally he wasn't real thrilled with what was going on with his agent, and when he got to AA, he switched over, and he promptly got suspended 100 games while I was visiting him, I think, and It was awful, and I helped him through the suspension, help rehabilitate that process, or help him go through the rehabilitation process, and he went to Kansas City in a trade that, unfortunately for him, did not work out. Then he got traded to Toronto, and they did a wonderful job medically helping him. But baseball-wise, the opportunity wasn't so terrific for him, and I'm not so sure the American League was good for him. And when he got designated the second time, he had a chance to take less money to go back to Milwaukee or stay in Toronto for more money. I suggested taking less money to get him back to the Brewers because I thought that's where he needed to be ultimately to get to where his potential level was or is. And I was right, so that was good. I told him.
Can I interrupt real quick? Why did you think that he wasn't a fit in the American League? That jumped out to me.
I mean, it didn't work out with Toronto. It didn't work out with Kansas City. The game's different. The chess match is different. Different game. It really matters. And he seemed to have had all of his success in the National League. And I just thought he was just the type of pitcher he is. It's very analytically, he profiled better as a National League pitcher.
Okay.
And I sent him back to I fielded offers from everybody, and there were good ones, but structurally, I thought the structure and the infrastructure with the Brewers was the best fit for Jeremy. And I had told him, I said, listen, you take less money and this doesn't work out, you can fire me. Like, that's how sure I am that this is going to work out for you. And I said, can you imagine, 6 months from now, 5 months from now, pitching down the stretch, 40,000 fans cheering from you. And then the best moment of my year last year by far was him striking out Buster Posey in September, on a changeup with two on, two out, and him coming off the mound, all adrenaline up and it's on MLB.com still, the video, and I think it's on YouTube, and it was the best moment of my season last year, and it worked out, and he's having a night leads league in appearances right now, and I don't know how long this is going to last. We joked about it yesterday, but he actually leads the league in average fastball velocity as of right now. I think he's like a tick higher than Aroldis Chapman, so I told him to enjoy that because he will not be winning that award. But as of right now, it's better than Chapman. So it's amazing. He was so close to losing everything, and now he's right up there with being one of the better relievers in baseball. It's such a cool story, and I'm happy that I was a part of it and am a part of it. And I've told this to people, and I've told this story a million times. If I was never born, Michael Brantley still would have been a superstar. I had nothing to do with that. But with Jeffress, I'm quite proud of what I was able to do to help him.
It's really extraordinary to see, kind of, if you have any idea of where he was to now, he's one of the best relief pitchers in the National League. It's really one of the best stories that isn't getting told enough in Major League Baseball right now.
Bob Nightingale did a good story on Josh Hamilton a few weeks ago that juxtaposed Josh's situation and how the Angels handled him versus how the Brewers handled Jeremy, and it's a good article. I was interviewed in it, and I got to talk about the Brewers' support system and regrettably commented on Josh Hamilton, which we discussed off-air. But it was a good story about Jeremy and his daily routine and struggle to maintain where he is. But if he didn't have the support of the ball club, amongst other people, all these things had to go right for him to make it through. And I'm just elated that he's doing this well, because this is the pitcher that he always should have been.
Well, now you got to start renegotiating, right?
Oh, God, I wish. I got one more year till he's arbitration eligible, so we'll see.
That'll be a fun time. That'll be a fun conversation.
It will probably be the most enjoyable conversation I have about his career when he finally gets paid.
Yeah, that'll be...
It's like the Simpsons line, Dr. Nick Riviera. It's like the most rewarding part is when he paid me my money.
That's when it was all worthwhile, was when I got paid.
No, I love Jeremy. I'm happy he is where he's at. And like I mentioned earlier, there was a really good story by Joe Lemire on Grantland comparing Boris's analytics department that cost $7 million and what CAA does with their analytics department versus what I do. And it's an interesting story. I've never been compared to those people before. It was a little jarring, but I do it differently than them. They're quite successful, and they're big business, and I'm the small guy, but you know, both ways seem effective in their own right, and it's a cool story. It explains the Jeffers situation, and it certainly explains how I negotiate versus the way that those guys do.
Yeah, I think that was a very nice piece for you, and it's always a good thing to be compared with Scott Boras, or in the same paragraph. Yeah, in the same article, anyways. I guess that's a good point.
Yeah, maybe. You know, I mean, I'll leave it at maybe. I don't want him to kill me.
Squash you. Yeah, right. So,
when you hold court at the winter meetings, I just walk away. But he had that one comment a couple years ago that I just loved. Somebody asked him what it was like getting fired by Robbie Cano right before his contract for Jay-Z, and Boris just looked at the reporter like he wanted to kill him, and he said it's one thing to use an umbrella, but it's one thing to have invented the umbrella. I gotta walk away.
That's a drop the mic moment. That's amazing.
Yeah, I was like, game over.
Done.
It's at that point, it's like, yeah, you're trying to steal all my clients, but, you know, that was cool. I don't care.
Yeah, right. I'm still the man. I still get it.
Yeah,
you're on my turf now. I'm not trying to rap. You're on my turf.
So. Yeah, it's like, you know, wow. Like, I don't even know the chemical reactions that would cause your brain to come up with that analogy. Like, I want to believe he was working on that, like, a comedy routine and was just waiting to use it.
Like he had that in his holster, just waiting for that, just drop the mic comment, just done.
I've done that before. I've said things where I'm like, come on, somebody asked me.
I'm ready. And, I got the best line ever.
Yeah, just someone asked, but no, honest to God, I saw it happen. It looked like he made it up on the spot. I'm like, that's just awesome.
And that's why Boris is Boris, right?
We in the industry like to refer to them as the corporation.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
Well, it's called the Scott Boras Corporation, so us in the industry like to call it the corporation.
Mm, well, yeah, I can see that. I don't even know how to transition off that. Yeah.
So I was gonna say, next time we do this, which hopefully is soon, we should delve into Marc Maron territory and delve into a little bit of how the hell I got here, because I think that would be a cool story.
Let's do it. That sounds great. Next time we'll cover...
I'd like to go full plagiarism, full Maron, and get into gory details of how I ended up in this godforsaken business.
That'll be the next show, because I would definitely love to go through your background. You have a very interesting background, and I think a lot of people would, frankly, love to hear how somebody becomes an agent.
Because I think that story not only would be book worthy if I wasn't so busy I'd like to write a book, but I have no time for this. But I think that story is every bit as interesting as my stupid opinions, because I've been through a lot, and I take none of this for granted. I'm very fortunate to be where I am, and shit, if it weren't for Marc Maron, why not?
Yeah, I tend to agree, yeah. Believe me, this medium doesn't exist without him to a certain degree as well, so.
My hero is Marc Maron, and as I like to brag, Marc Maron has tweeted at me, and so has DJ Kitty, the mascot of the Tampa Bay Rays.
You might be the only person that's had those two both tweet at you. That might be the, you might be Han Solo on that one.
I love it. the best, do you want to hear the coup de grace of that? I tweeted, I can't believe that Marc Maron and DJ Kitty both tweeted me in the same lifetime. And then whoever runs the account for DJ Kitty wrote, now you've been tweeted back twice by DJ Kitty. Boom.
Boom.
So, twice by DJ Kitty, once by Mark Maron. Oh, no, twice by Mark Maron. I'm sorry. So they're tied. It is twice by Maron, twice by DJ Kitty.
All right, so now we've got a challenge out there. Who's going to be the third? Who's going to get up in the lead?
And several times by John Butchergrass, who I work for.
John's, you know, that's a given. That's a given. So
that one doesn't, I guess that doesn't count. I am, you know, it's kind of sucks. I think I'm disqualified from the Bucci Overtime Challenge, so I can never win that. Wait, quick Butchergrass story for his birthday, like 6 years ago. On his voicemail, he would say, "This is John, leave a message," and his favorite hockey name was a guy who played for the Flames in the 80s named Hockin' Lou.
I remember that guy, yeah.
Okay, so that was his favorite name player ever, and he's like, "Leave a message, Hockin' Lou," and that was his voicemail. And for his birthday, I sent him a Flames jersey of Hockin' Lou.
I used to collect that kid's cards. Oh, wow, I remember that name. That's so funny.
So I got him a custom-made Hockin' Lou jersey. And he was crying, laughing, wearing, you know, he told me all these horrible stories of where he wore the jersey, and he's like, "I'm not taking it off ever." And that might be one of the better birthday gifts I've ever given someone.
That's amazing. That's a great gift, and only a few people remember that guy and that name.
Hockin' Lou.
Sounds like
that's a good hockey name.
Sounds like a porn name too. Another topic though.
it's a good hockey name though. Man, what, you think he was from Finland?
He definitely was.
Yeah, he was a Finnish hockey player, but I think I told you I played hockey for 13 years. I was supposed to go to the University of Indiana to play goalie, and then I played club at Florida State instead.
No, I didn't know you played hockey.
I did, 13 years. I was a goalie. All 5'7", 185 pounds of Jew of me.
I realized
at 18 I was not going to be a pro athlete, so to play club Division III hockey, probably not going to lead me to the NHL, so I'd rather go to my dream school, Florida State, instead.
So you were a little more Julie the Cat than Goldberg in the goal.
I was good. I was good, man. I think I was the number one ranked player in Florida, which at the time meant absolutely nothing because there was no hockey here. But I was a goalie. I was a really good goalie. I miss it. My knees are shot now and I'm 33, but I was good, man. I mean, back then we only had like rec leagues, but they had a rec league draft. I think four times I was the number one overall pick.
I keep learning new stuff about you. This is amazing.
Yeah, I miss playing hockey.
Now, you didn't rig the draft now because you're an agent, right? You didn't do that.
Yeah, I was. This was before my agent dream was the twinkle in my eye. But I was the first pick like four times, and I remember my last year playing when I was 19, I think. I was in a men's league, and a bunch of former NHL players were in it. Like Alexander Mogilny played in it, and Sergei Nemchinov, and I mean, they destroyed us. I don't think I made one save on those guys ever. And, literally never made a save on them.
Well, Mogilny went for, like, 60 goals in a season. I mean, he was amazing.
He scored 76 one year.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
And then he's coming out and playing in our rec league. It's like, what are you doing? This isn't fair. And, I remember that year they didn't have a draft, and I signed up late. So they did, like, a reassignment because the team stayed together every year. And they assigned me to the worst team in the league. Like, they went 0-15 the year before. But then the one year I played for before I went to college, we went 8-7 and made the playoffs. And it was single elimination. So in the first round of the playoffs, I had like a 53-save shutout. And then in the second round of the playoffs, in the semifinals, we went into quadruple overtime, and then they decided to play a shootout, which we won. I stopped all three shots, and I was dead. Like, I thought I was going to die. I mean, it was quadruple overtime and then a shootout. I thought I was going to die. I don't know how I made those three saves. And then in the finals, they like the team we were playing had one former NHL player on it, and I got torched, and we lost 7-3.
So you knew exactly what your skill level was. You were dominating the rec league guys. As soon as you played an NHLer, it was a problem.
Yeah. Well, the thing that sucked is that my biggest regret, I played rec league hockey and high school hockey for, 13 years or something. And in those 13 years, I lost 3 championships. I never won a championship, and it pisses me off to this day.
Well, you are competitive.
I got to the finals 3 times, and all 3 times I lost. And the first 2 times, I completely blamed my teammates because I was a teenager. But the last one, I got torched. I was oh my god, it was ugly, and it was probably one of the worst games I ever had. And it was. And it wasn't like I was unprepared. I was, super ready at the finals, and I'm playing against a former NHLer, and everything's cool. And I think the first 3 shots went in. The confidence was gone. Because with a goalie, it's all momentum and confidence. And, you let the first – I mean, sometimes you can get away with letting the first shot in and then rebound and be okay. First couple shots go in, you're like, this is over.
Yeah, right. We're down 3-0. This is an issue. Yeah.
Well, and the worst thing was, I was named goalie of the year that year, but we didn't have a backup, so I couldn't even get pulled. So I was in there for all 7.
I was going to say, they were definitely looking to pull you after 3 shots, 3 goals.
I was looking to pull me. I was after the 5th goal, I was like, can we end this? Can we put me out of my misery?
You're looking for the shoulder tap, okay, son, you're out, next.
I looked at the bench. I was like, does anyone want to do this? But yeah, let's do this again next week, and let me know how this goes. I'm excited. I'm happy to have a show back, and for the love of God, make sure that intro song's there, because that always makes me happy.
Absolutely. We will take care of it.
And we also have to talk about me watching Kurt Cobain's montage of Heck last week, which was the day after my birthday, which I was so happy that it came out, and then thoroughly depressed after watching it.
Well, yeah, that kind of does it. Birthdays at our age are really not that fun, and you're never going to catch me, which is really a bummer, so...
Yeah, but watching the Kurt Cobain documentary after my birthday, holy God, that was a tough documentary to watch.
Yeah, it's amazing how quick that shining star left us, kind of, so to speak.
Yeah, if you want to talk about really feeling bad about how old we are, he's been dead 20 years.
I know. That's pretty crazy. I was listening to a Nirvana song the other day on Sirius, and it put up, it was like 1993. I was like, oh my God, that was 22 years ago. You got to be kidding me.
Yeah, I mean, and the crazy thing is Nirvana, Bleach was released in 89, which nobody bought Bleach, but from the time Smells Like Teen Spirit came out to the time he died, it was from November of 91 to April of 94, so they were around for like 3 years, and that was it, and that's the kind of impact he made.
Yeah, big piece of trivia I have is I think Teen Spirit came out 1 week before even Pearl Jam's 10, if I remember that.
Yes, that's true.
And totally changed the music scene. It was 1 week, and I think Nirvana was first.
Yeah, Nirvana they knocked Michael Jackson's Dangerous off the number 1 chart.
And music completely changed. I mean, literally that week.
In one week, he killed hair metal.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a big Nirvana hike, and it's cool. I don't know if you heard, they're releasing a Kurt Cobain acoustic, unreleased acoustic album this summer.
I did, and I'm
Which
sure I will be...
thrilled me to death, because I never thought I was going to hear a new Nirvana song or Cobain song the rest of my life.
Yeah, that should be really... I thought their Unplugged was probably their best performance they ever did in some ways.
Oh my God, watching Where Did You Sleep last night is still hauntingly... awesome.
Yeah, I'm a Plateau guy from that album myself, but
that was a Meat Puppet song, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, I'm a music nerd, so I'm sure this show will devolve into that.
Well, that's we're looking forward to it. So next week we're going to talk your background in Nirvana. So I hope.
Well, please do. That is more fun to me than baseball. I mean, we can always do baseball, but I think I've got more interesting stories than baseball.
Well, I'm looking forward to episode 2, and I'm sure the audience is as well. So,
awesome.
Josh, let me give you a spot here for your plugs, where people can find you at Twitter, social media, your work, whatever you want to plug.
It's my name, Joshua Kuznick. At AOL.com is my email. It's at Joshua Kuznick on Twitter, and my cell phone is stolen.
Exactly, and no. So, all right, Josh, great to talk to you this week. I think this went really well, and I'm looking forward to episode two.
Awesome, me too. Talk to you next week.
Sounds good, Josh. And with that, our first show is a wrap. I hope everyone enjoyed this hour of baseball talk discussing the business side of the game and hearing from MLB certified agent Josh Kuznick. Thank you so much, and we will be back next time.